The following is for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial advice. This discussion is a presentation by 1031, the leading institutional investor focused on the Bitcoin ecosystem. 1031 has over 10 years of experience in Bitcoin and has deployed nearly $150 million into the leading opportunities in the space. To learn more, visit 1031.vc.
I saw it in my feed. I ended up missing my next meeting, because I had to figure out how long will it take for us to crack the encryption standards that we use for Bitcoin. Nick, here's the answer, because I was so tilted by this idea. So if you think of Willow as essentially like one stable, logical qubit equivalent in a chip, we need about 4,000 to break RSA 2048. And we need about 8,000 to break SHA-256, which is the underlying encryption framework for Bitcoin. So I think you're right. I think we're in the sort of like...
the end game?
2 to 5 year shot clock. No, I mean, I think what'll have to happen is some of these chains will need to obviously re-implement something at a pretty foundational level. The weird thing, as Freeberg says, is like the Willow chip's error correction gets better the more of these things you start to use together. Now, there are some really big problems inside these chips, like logical interconnects are very complicated. If you put two chips on a board, like the C2C communication is complicated. This, all this stuff that we haven't figured out how to do, but this is a big deal. And I was really like, my God, what's going on here?
Ooh, quantum computing coming to break Bitcoin. Welcome back to Bitcoin Alpha. John, Grant, and myself are not well-equipped enough to comment on this, so we brought in prolific Bitcoin developer Matt Corallo, currently working on LDK at Spiral, BTC. He wrote an email to the mailing list, a Bitcoin dev mailing list, which is now on Google Groups, which I'm not a big fan of, but we found it anyway, about this. Everybody's up in arms, Matt, about Chamath saying Bitcoin's going to be broken in 2 years. What's going on here?
Yeah, there are a lot of things wrong with that clip. So Google announced, Google's had a fairly large investment in quantum, building up quantum computing for quite some time. One of the most advanced teams, if not the most advanced team, doing quantum computing research and trying to build quantum computers. And they came out with a new paper the other day, I guess last week, that was interesting, kind of a continuation of research that they had been doing, for a long time, and continuation of results that they have been getting on their quantum computing research platform for the last, few years, the last 2-3 years. And prior to, so there are a number of issues with scaling up quantum computing, right? To get from where we are today or where we were two decades ago to a quantum computer that can actually pose a threat to cryptographic algorithms that we have today. And unlike what Chamath said, it's not SHA-256 we're worried about, but really ECDSA, but we can get into that in a minute. And to scale up a quantum computer to that scale has a lot of challenges. But one of them, for a long time, it was the case that as you add more qubits, as you add more things in your quantum computer, more resource power, more memory in your quantum computer, suddenly the quantum computer becomes less stable. And so you have to add more qubits on top to get error correction, to add error correction in so that the resulting computation, you can correct for that stability and you can actually get useful results out. For up until a year or two ago, it was the case that for every new qubit you added, you needed more than one qubit for error correction, which obviously doesn't allow you to scale up because you add a qubit and you need more than one qubit to compensate for the extra noise you just added, and suddenly you obviously can't scale a quantum computer. Google's results over the last few years have, they've been claiming, and it seems like they're now continuing to show, that they're actually below that threshold now, so they can add more qubits and get less noise on a per qubit basis, allowing them to scale up the quantum computer. But this doesn't mean that they're anywhere remotely close to being able to add, I mean, Chamath quoted a few thousand of their Willow chips, to be able to build a chip that has that many qubits and then can also perform computation on it. So it's important to recognize that not only do you need several orders of magnitude more qubits than they're able to build, but on top of that, you then have to actually keep it stable for a long time and do a bunch of computation on it. So Willow, Google's, again, one of probably the most advanced quantum research lab in the world, is able to keep their computer running for, you know, few microseconds, few milliseconds, few seconds, but you need a lot more, potentially, you know, an order of magnitude more than they're able to keep it going in order to actually do useful computation at the scale we're talking about to break Bitcoin. So we have a long time, this 2 to 3 year time horizon. I don't think anyone serious in the quantum computer world has ever claimed that, not even close. Certainly, I've never seen a quantum computer researcher claiming anything on that scale. More like a decade or 2 decades is more realistic. If you just look at the qubit count and you don't look at how long we're able to keep it stable or how much computation we're able to do on the qubit, just looking at the scale, the slow rate of additional qubits they've been adding over the last decade or two of research, we're still talking about, you know, 7-8 years before this is realistic. But then you have to add on top how long you have to keep it stable and your ability to do computation on it. And it's just, it's not a soon thing, not even remotely. We have some time. So what would we do, you know, in 10 years, maybe we should start thinking about how to get ready. I think we should, it's probably a good opportunity to, you know, take this, isn't fundamentally new research, but it's a good chance to take it as an opportunity to say, like, we should think about how to get ready for a decade from now or whenever. And there's two classes of things we're worried about in Bitcoin. So we're worried about the signature algorithm. So that would be ECDSA and more generally any elliptic curve operations. So that includes short signatures, really just any cryptographic signatures that people use today. Also applies to RSA and other things that Bitcoin doesn't use. And then the other thing we're worried about is proof of work. So we'll get into that in a minute maybe. But first we'll talk about signatures. So signatures, fundamentally, with the standard signatures that people use today, so that would be elliptic curve operations, RSA, whatever, a quantum computer can generally figure out your private key, right? So it is tractable, still takes a non-trivial amount of computation, a bunch of time, but it is tractable for a quantum computer to calculate your private key, just given your public key. So they can look at the blockchain, they can calculate a bunch of private keys, and they can steal your money. There are various post-quantum cryptography schemes, so cryptographic signature algorithms that we believe are secure against quantum computers. And they can be broken down into a few different categories. One is hash-based, so they use things like SHA-256, which, contrary to Chamath's claim, is in fact not broken by quantum computers, not at all broken by quantum computers. And they use that to build up signatures, so it's a fairly easy to prove secure scheme, but they're very inefficient. They require very large public keys, very large signatures. You know, we'd be talking about using a tenth of the block just to get a transaction in, or maybe a 50th of the block, but they're pretty big. It's doable, but it's pretty big. Then there are a bunch of more speculative schemes, so based on different cryptographic assumptions, so different assumptions that we make that certain problems are hard. You know, we take some math problem and we say, like, well, we don't know how to solve it. And so we assume that no one else is going to figure out how to solve it. And then we're just going to build cryptographic things on this problem being hard. But if this problem turns out to not be hard, then people could, again, steal your money, steal your private keys, whatever. And the post-quantum cryptography schemes that exist are a little more sketch there, you know, just newer assumptions that haven't been as well tested, that are a little more complicated, that are a little more likely to potentially be broken in the future. And in fact, we have seen this. We've seen cryptographic, post-quantum cryptographic algorithms that people are fairly confident in be suddenly broken by a breakthrough where someone's like, oh, actually, that problem is easy. I know how to fix that. Or I know how to address that problem or solve that problem. So we probably don't want to rely on that for Bitcoin. And hash-based, so that leaves us with just hash-based signatures, which are big. You know, they have this problem that they're big, but at least they're easy to build. And we can be fairly confident that they're secure. So to finally get to Marty's point from originally, where he mentioned that I had posted this mailing list post. This wasn't really my idea. It's, in fact, an old idea. I hadn't seen it. I don't think it was on the mailing list. I don't think it had been discussed publicly. But there's kind of a few schemes rotating around where people are proposing basically the same high-level concept, right, where you somehow build your address on-chain or your public key or whatever such that you have a quantum public, a post-quantum hash-based signature public key in there, but you don't use it. So you don't have to use it today. You can just ignore it. It's just hidden there. It doesn't have any cost. And then in the future, if we get to the point where, oh, quantum computers are starting to be a real threat, you know, they're starting to get these things up to the number of qubits they need, they're starting to be able to actually do the amount of computation they need, and they're getting them, like, to be stable for minutes and not small fractions of a second, then we can say, all right, we're going to soft work out the existing signature schemes. We're just going to say, like, you can't use that anymore, and you better have been building your public keys in these other ways, and then you can just start signing with the new algorithms. And hopefully by the time we get there, again, we're talking about what is most likely a decade or two away. When we get there, hopefully we'll have better post-quantum signature schemes. We can soft work those in, but even wallets that exist today would still be secure. So even wallets that exist today, no quantum computer adversary would be able to just steal all that Bitcoin. You would just have to build really large transactions that are maybe expensive to claim your money back. And then we could use more advanced algorithms that are built over the next decade. So I think these things are not a big worry, but it's something that we might want to start working on. Sadly, this is a harder problem than in more traditional schemes. So things like Signal, iMessage, TLS, have started deploying post-quantum cryptography schemes, but they've been using schemes that are pretty sketchy, where it's not unlikely that they might be broken in the next handful of years. And they use them layered in combination with traditional schemes. So as long as the traditional schemes secure, they're fine. But if someone suddenly builds a quantum computer, they're also fine, assuming this quantum scheme is secure, which is maybe a dubious assumption, but maybe. We can't really do that in Bitcoin because we'd be like putting it in the part of consensus, and then we have to maintain this thing, and then it turns out it's broken. It's just not really a great option for us. So we're stuck with hash-based, but I think we have a pretty good answer there. So then there's the other question. So then there's proof of work. We can solve the signature schemes. We should start doing stuff. Wallets should start deploying this stuff, but we've got some time. But what do we do with proof of work? So I mentioned that, you know, Chamath is wrong. The SHA-256 is not broken by quantum computers. The quantum computer cannot reverse a SHA-256 hash and come up with the preimage. But they do get a speed up. So they are able to calculate a probable preimage with the square root of the amount of work as a classical computer. So it's 256 bits, square rooted is 128 bits. 128 bits is still more security than you would ever need. Quantum computers still can't feasibly do anything about that. But that doesn't apply for mining, right? Because mining, we're talking about 70 bits, square root that, and, well, suddenly a quantum computer can calculate a block that meets the difficulty fairly easily. There's not a clear answer here. But I think there's a lot of room to maneuver. It's not something that we should be worried about because it depends a lot on exactly what the quantum computers end up looking like that people are able to build. So in, you know, 7 years, as this field progresses, we'll presumably learn a lot more about what types of quantum computers are stable, what the performance characteristics of quantum computers look like, and is likely to be the case. You know, quantum computers aren't instant. You don't just like snap your fingers and all the computation is done. They still require some amount of time for each gate. And so it might well be the case that quantum computers have some latency. And if we just take the Bitcoin proof of work functions, Bitcoin proof of work function today is SHA-256 hash twice, so we run SHA-256 twice. If we just run it a million times, then it might be the case that it takes a quantum computer, you know, the theoretically most efficient possible quantum computer, 2 hours to calculate a block. Well, okay, who cares? Block's already done, it's been 10 minutes. The traditional miners will still be able to outcompete it. Or maybe if it takes, you know, quantum computer, if we can scale it such that it takes the quantum computer a day or a week, then yeah, okay, you know, reorgs get more complicated, but we solve this problem. We just, miners, more traditional miners are still able to operate normally. It's just not an issue. It could be a little different. You know, it might be that quantum computers are faster than we think. We can't get this kind of a slowdown on quantum computers. We have to change to a different algorithm entirely, not SHA-256, but something different. But it seems fairly likely that we'll be able to come up with something. And again, we don't really know enough because these quantum computers are still so early. And I know they've been being worked on for 2.5 decades now, but they are still very early in terms of what they can actually build and what they can actually do. They're so limited today that we just don't really have a good sense for what they're going to end up looking like by the time and if they ever end up being able to do the kinds of operations we're talking about. We just don't know what the performance characteristics are going to look like. So it's hard to speculate, but it's not really something that we need to worry too much about because they can't fundamentally break the protocol. We just have to change the proof of work in some way that is even harder for a quantum computer to do in a way that's not necessarily as hard for a traditional computer.
All right, so brief rehash here, pun intended. Two parts of Bitcoin that would be affected by this: private public key pair creation and hashing from the mining industry that creates the hash that allows them to add a block of transactions, get reward in Bitcoin as a result. And the ability of these quantum computers is nowhere near where it would be a legitimate threat to Bitcoin. And most importantly, I think there's individuals like Matt out there already thinking about this problem and maybe not an exactly clear path on what the solutions are, but a clear enough path where it's like, okay, we can maneuver to prepare for this. There is time to prepare. And I guess that gets into the other question, which is, it's hilarious when quantum leaps are made in the quantum computer landscape and everybody points to Bitcoin first. But I think Bitcoin unfairly gets signaled out, where if these threats were to materialize the way they're being marketed, Bitcoin would not be the only network that is vulnerable to a quantum attack.
Yeah, and I mean, the NSA has been beating the drum of things should start transitioning for a while, but it's only really finally standardizing cryptographic algorithms to allow people to do that. Now and over the last 2 or 3 years and over the coming year or two, the NSA is setting a timeline of like people have a decade, right? So the NSA is recommending that all of these other things, and you're right, there are a lot of cryptographic schemes out there, there's a lot of TLS and bank security and whatever that uses various cryptographic schemes. And, you know, even the NSA is saying, you've got 10 years to do it. You're all right. You know, if you're worried about, you know, the thing that I think there is a little bit of a loss here where people get confused because there are a lot of cryptographers who are like, no, we have to transition now. And in a lot of those cases, we're not talking about things where they're worried about a quantum computer existing next year. They're worried about if you take this data that was encrypted, or your signal conversations or your iMessage conversations, and you just save the encrypted data for 10 years or whatever it takes to get a quantum computer, you could then go back and read that encrypted content, right? And so if you have this kind of system where you're worried about people reading the encrypted content way down the line after the fact, then you should start transitioning now. You should be worried about this, you know, quantum computer still might, in fact, not happen, still might not be possible. We might find a number of limitations that we are still aware of or we might find over the course of the development. But assuming they do get built, then they'd be able to read your old conversations, and maybe that's not great. Whereas we're not worried about the same kind of thing in Bitcoin. You know, if someone is able to go back and recover or steal your private key from 5 years ago that doesn't have any money on it anymore, kind of who cares? I mean, like, okay, they could, but like, kind of who cares? So it's not the same type of attack model that we're worried about. We do need to, you know, transition wallets because, you know, wallets take a while to transition. People take a while to upgrade. We should worry about this, but not, we have a very different threat model than a lot of these systems that where people are kind of rushing to transition. And we have different constraints that make it a little harder to do that.
Yeah. So essentially the wallet software would update. And if you were to input a public address associated with a private key that was quantum vulnerable, the wallet software could say, you can't send your Bitcoin here.
I was thinking more about just the way that you generate your own keys such that you have an upgrade path, right? It's one of the variation that I propose is a little different, but one of the simplified schemes that other people have proposed is that you just take your private key and you make your private key a post-quantum public key, right? So it's pretty easy to understand, right? So you just, instead of your private key, which is just random numbers, you use a post-quantum public key as your private key, and then you transact like normal. No one needs to know that you happen to create your private key in this way. But if there were to be a quantum computer, we were to worry about it, we could soft fork out the traditional spend, or we could, I guess it's a hard fork, but we disable the traditional spend path. And now, okay, a quantum computer can calculate your private key, but your private key is now the post-quantum public key. And so who cares? You're just like, all right, well, your public key is revealed. Anytime you spend it, you in fact reveal that private key, which is now just your public key. And then you do a post-quantum signature, and then you're safe. So there's these simple schemes like this where wallets can start to transition how they make their private keys such that they will be secure even if a quantum computer is built in the future. They won't have to do anything. We'll just do a simple soft fork around that time, and it won't be a big deal.
To be clear on kind of the implementation path to get there, you know, I see on the first kind of comment on what you wrote was from Luke Desch Jr. talking about how you might not even necessarily need a soft fork potentially to make this happen. And I think for people who are familiar with kind of the Bitcoin's upgrade process, you know, that might be to steel man kind of the concern troll side of this. It's, you know, soft forks are increasingly difficult to get through, and it's hard to settle on consensus. And there are going to be, you know, more and more kind of interests at the table wanting this thing or that thing. So are there, I guess, A, would you worry about that in this case? And then B, if so, how do you think about the potential to solve this kind of without something like a soft fork?
Yeah, I mean, I think soft forks, the whole soft forks are hard thing is to some extent a result of people misreading certain soft forks being more controversial than they feel like they should be. I don't think soft forks are that hard, but I think, I think Luke's point was well made that, if wallets were to standardize on a scheme to do this, like the scheme I just described or the scheme I described in the mailing list post, then wallets could start upgrading today, could start doing this, and wouldn't need to worry too much about consensus today. We wouldn't need to do a soft fork today. You do need to do a soft fork at the point in the future where a quantum computer becomes a real threat. But I don't buy that would be difficult because the alternative is the system falling apart and being unusable. So at that point, there just is no alternative. It doesn't matter whether there's consensus or not. If some people start following a chain that has this rule enabled, then that chain still functions, and other people who don't are just going to have a useless coin where all the money is stolen. Like, that's not... There's no, you by definition have consensus because the other branch is dysfunctional. So I don't think that's a concern at all.
I would agree there. Just for a point of clarification, if we were, wallets were to begin implementing this, and I think it's good, would it necessitate a move of coins from public addresses that exist today to these new addresses?
Yeah, you would have to move your coins if you were worried about it. But of course, you have a decade to do that, or you have, you know, however long. I mean, I'm not a sufficient expert to give you a real number of like how long you have, but it's not 2 to 3 years. It's quite a while. Even optimistic predictions are quite a while. So you have quite a bit of time to move your coins. You don't need to like rush to move them. And probably you were already going to move your coins at some point in the next 5 or 7 years anyway. And just if you use, you know, hopefully wallet software adopts this. And then of course, if you use that new wallet software and you move your coins at any point or touch your coins at any point, then you would get the security for free.
Just to, I mean, maybe for people who at the 10,000 foot view who are not highly technical, and I think that describes all three of us on this call, not named Matt. If you're worried about, you know, if you're really, really worried about this, and I think the answer to this is yes, but curious if there are any nuances that you would throw in there. If you're worried about tomorrow, you wake up and ECDSA is broken by a quantum computer that we never knew was in development, but it exists and it's breaking ECDSA. At that point, I believe it's the case that only P2PK coins and P2PK addresses, so an old legacy address type, or post P2PK addresses that have been reused are vulnerable, like, you know, in that doomsday scenario where you wake up and that happens, and any coins held on unused or addresses used only once post P2PK are safe. So I think that's the case, and if so or if not, correct me if I'm wrong, but
Not exactly. It also applies to Taproot.
Okay, yep.
So Taproot also has the public keys explicitly on chain. But in practice, there's just so, I mean, at a minimum, there's, you know, something give or take a million coins in pay to pub key explicit outputs that are just very old coins, many of which attributed to Satoshi, but who knows. That could be stolen and then, of course, dumped on the market. So I think that the doomsday scenario there is that it happens, coins are stolen and then dumped on the market. And what you would have to do then is roll it all back, right? So there are cryptographic schemes today. Again, they're a little more, they rely on a little more novel mathematical assumptions of hard problems. But that exist where we could do, we could prove the knowledge of the private key, and we could allow you to just start doing that today that are post-quantum, right? So even with your existing private key, with no changes on chain, no new transactions, no anything, you could just wake up today, wake up tomorrow, we could do a soft fork that requires a different signature scheme that allows you to prove knowledge of the private key you could prove knowledge of the seed that went into the private key. So it does depend a little bit on how the wallet was constructed, but most wallets use some kind of seed that is hashed and then used to make a private key. And you could prove knowledge of that seed. And then we could require that for spending, which would lock up a bunch of coins, but not all coins. And you would still, like most wallets would still be able to function. So it would be bad, but it wouldn't necessarily be the end of the world. And so I think, you know, that in practice, that is kind of why it's useful to start thinking about this and start deploying some of these schemes and wallets. But at the same time, I think that is very, very unlikely. It's just we're so far away from it, and it's not for, if we were far away from it because no one had been doing research in quantum computers, then maybe tomorrow we'll wake up and someone will have a clever idea. But it's not for lack of funding or trying or research to build quantum computers over the last 2 decades. There has been a lot of money and brain power poured into this problem. You know, there are of course all kinds of tail risks to Bitcoin. This is one of them, but it is very much a tail risk.
All right, you ease my nerves. Chamath had me a little scared, I'm not gonna lie. I'm kidding. I think
if Chamath is scaring you about things, you might want to consider finding better sources of information.
I was kidding, but thank you for doing this. What can we get a brief update on LDK Lightning? I have one question. A combination of Lightning and Arc, is that something that excites you at all?
Potentially. Yeah, well, I mean, on scaling, there's this whole scaling question of, you know, what do we do in between Lightning and custodial? Kind of like, you know, I think of scaling as like a continuum. I think the end future of wallets has to be this kind of graduated, automatic graduation of wallets, right? Where you get your wallet and your first 100 sats you receive is totally custodial. And the next 1,000,000 sats you receive, they start custodial, and then your wallet automatically opens a Lightning channel for you and moves you on chain. You know, as you get more money, it automatically improves your security model. When we see the early innings of this stuff being built, it's still a little bit away, but there's early innings. There's an open question of kind of what you do between a full on-chain Lightning and a custodial, like an eCash Mint or whatever. Lightning on top of something like Arc is one candidate. This also goes by the term timeout trees, which was invented independently of Arc, but is basically the same thing as Lightning on top of Arc. It's compelling. It's interesting. It has a number of issues where the LSP could do certain attacks that might allow it to steal more money than they should be able to. It's unclear how easy to fix these issues are, but it's an interesting candidate, and I'm happy people are researching it more, but it certainly won't be a replacement for full on-chain Lightning for everyone.
Yeah. At least to me, my understanding, based on the conversations I've had, at least for channel liquidity management, combining Arc and Lightning to do some sort of automatic channel balancing seems like a good UX upgrade.
Yeah, I think for automatic channel balancing, like if you're a server or something, if you're like a routing node, you probably want to look more towards multi-party channels than moving your channels to be on top of Arc. I think Arc makes a little more sense for kind of the edge nodes, like your mobile wallets or whatever, that want to be less custodial, have less trust, but still want some more scalability. It potentially makes a lot of sense there. Again, there's some big open questions. There's some attack scenarios that are very challenging to address. Basically, the most damning one is the LSP can take all the poor people and put them in a ghetto and then steal money from all the poor people, and none of them can afford on-chain fees to fix the problem. You're kind of assuming, the whole model assumes you have a mix of wallet balances, some wallets with lots of money, some with less money, where the wallets with lots of money can pay some of the on-chain fees to punish the LSP if they cheat. But I think that the LSP can put all the poor people in the ghetto and then screw them over. So there's some big open questions remaining on how to build these things. Potential answers to more research needed.
Awesome. Well, John, Grant, you guys have any questions? I asked for 10 to 15 minutes of your time. We're 45 minutes into you hopping on this call, so I want to be respectful of that. But thank you for agreeing to do this. John, Grant, anything to add here?
No, I don't think so. This was a slightly more informed discussion than what we cold opened with. So appreciate you coming on to give a little more information.
Of course. Yeah, thanks.
Anybody who's listening to this and does not know Matt's work throughout Bitcoin, he's been on TFTC multiple times throughout the year. I think you were guest two on the show back when we were drinking beers at Barstool's offices. He's doing very important work and is obviously much smarter than we are on the technical aspects of what's going on with Bitcoin. So Matt, really appreciate you taking some time to join us and walk us through this.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Matt Carallo for joining us, educating us. It's important to understand that there's a lot of people that are going to FUD Bitcoin that don't know what they're talking about. Chamath being one of those people. And John, I knew you had one point you wanted to follow up on in terms of synopsis and the expected value calculation how that fits into all of this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and just quickly to your point on the FUD, for those who are maybe newer to the space and are kind of looking at Bitcoin for the first time, I would just note that this is far from a new concern. You know, we generally see this is among, you know, the 10 or 20 most common objections that we see floated once a year, once every 2 years, whenever there's kind of an incremental headline on this or other things like this. You know, this becomes the topic of conversation for a week or two. So it's far from the first time that anyone has been, as Matt said, you know, thinking about this or worrying about this or considering how to deal with it. So important to remember that. But to me, like, my just pulling back from an investor's perspective, and I kind of went through this when I was first coming into Bitcoin and kind of understanding it, when looking at this tail risk, you know, even if I think you just have to assess it on kind of an expected value basis, which is the, you know, how you should probably look at kind of like a multi-node analysis of virtually any investment. But if you very simply just decompose the quantum computing bear case for Bitcoin and, you know, say like there's a reality where you have doomsday scenario and developers and wallet providers, et cetera, are not able to combat sudden, you know, shifts in the quantum landscape and Bitcoin goes to zero as a result of it kind of overnight. You could think of that as, let's say that's a 50% probability of that happening. I think that that is probably overstating it by multiple orders of magnitude based on, you know, everything that Matt said over the last half hour. But let's just say, to be very conservative and aggressive, that it's 50% chance. And in the other kind of branch of reality, there's a 50% chance that Bitcoin, that doesn't happen. And Bitcoin generally proceeds on the adoption path that we think it's going to. And the Bitcoiners are directionally right. And Bitcoin eats 10 or 20 or 30 or 50% or something of global wealth. And you have Bitcoin at the end of the day, over whatever investment horizon matters to you, 10, 20, 50 years, you know, at a 50, 100, $200 trillion market cap. Okay. In that reality, Bitcoin is multiple millions of dollars per Bitcoin. And then apply the 50% weighting to that. And you've got, you know, probably multiple millions of dollars, even probability adjusted. So you add those two together, and what you get in the expected value calculation there is multiple millions of dollars. Bitcoin is, you know, a 20th of that or a 50th of that, or wherever the math would shake out for you, depending on how you want to think about its ultimate potential. And so from that basis, even if you think there's a 50% chance that Bitcoin zeros because of overnight quantum computing risk, it is still a screaming buy here on an expected value basis. So it's just important to remember always, like, when these kind of FUD categories come up, the prize that Bitcoin is playing for is so massive, and it has, I think, such a good chance of capturing some version of that prize, that even these tiny, you know, left tail risks, if you applied massively high probabilities to them that are probably not justified, you still probably come to the conclusion that you should buy Bitcoin. So I think it's just important to frame the whole discussion, you know, from that perspective for an investor.
No, it's a very good way to put it. And I didn't even think of the expected value calculation before you put it in the show notes, and it makes a lot of sense. Even if you do think it's a significant risk, which John mentioned probably isn't, but if you even want to put that type of risk on it, turn the dial up, run the slide up to 50% chance, like, it's still a very good risk adjusted time to get into Bitcoin. So that's what's great about this industry. Being able to get people like Matt on, who's done incredible work for the Bitcoin protocol, now the Lightning Network. I feel very fortunate to call Matt a friend and be able to send him a text in the morning and have him on the show to walk us through what's going on. But there's a bunch of other stuff going on in the industry. Grant, you've been a bit quiet. We have on the list to talk about our road shows that we've been on. I was in the Middle East. You were traveling here in the United States, talking to family offices. And I think it'd be interesting to get your perspective on the state of U.S. family offices and how they're viewing Bitcoin right now, based off your travels.
Sure. I guess maybe I would start with just my thoughts on this whole, the last however long we were going on quantum, which would be, like, I think the market agrees with John, with you, with what Matt said. It's sort of like the simplistic way to say what John just said, you know, if there really were a seismic shift, a catastrophic development that suggested there's a much more meaningful threat to Bitcoin, I think that would be reflected in the price. And I haven't checked the price in the last 20 seconds or so, but I'm pretty sure it's still moving market upwards. I think that none of these questions or criticisms are new. We've seen them for years. But in my travels, I've been spending a decent amount of time with these types of groups. And I would say by far, you know, John, you said it's like one of the most common 20 questions or so that you get. Even before the Willow Google announcement, this was the number one question I've been seeing. But even before that, I mean, I understand why afterwards it is, but for some reason or another, it's on top of everyone's minds who's not really paying that close attention to Bitcoin. I would say that people generally in the family office crowd are definitely getting more interested in paying attention. MicroStrategy has caused a lot of attention to the Bitcoin space. All the positive regulatory backdrop and everything that's happening in DC as well. But I would say it's still really early. There's still a lot of groups who haven't really started to dive into it. And so they're reciting a lot of the common questions that we always get, but inclusive of this quantum computing question. I never really thought I would be spending so much time on that question, but here we are.
Yeah, it's been around for a while. And that's, I think one thing I would add to this broad conversation about quantum computing is the caliber of individuals like Matt Corallo and others focused on the Bitcoin distributed software project is unmatched, at least in my bump-ins with other sort of protocol experiments that are going on out there, protocols that are being worked on. I think we're in good hands, and it's one thing that we should be mentioned. There are a number of open source contributors, cryptographers that spend a lot of thankless hours thinking of these problems and putting their fingers to the keyboard to actually solve these problems, to create solutions. Bitcoin is an open source distributed software project at the end of the day. And there are an incredible amount of highly talented, incredibly smart individuals focused on these problems. And when it comes to the specter of quantum computing and its threat, not only to Bitcoin, to the world, like I actually feel most comfortable with my money parked in Bitcoin, knowing that there are some of the smartest people in the world focused on ensuring that Bitcoin could survive the emergence of a quantum computer, which, as Matt mentioned, is still in question. There have certainly been some checkpoints that have been reached and some progress that has been made, but I think still, if you talk to many people, many physicists, it is still a question of whether or not it's even possible at the end of the day.
It also has, I mean, Bitcoin also benefits from a pretty unique dynamic where there is a deeply embedded incentive for the developers that you're talking about, Marty, to get it right and to think about this stuff proactively and to move quickly to the extent that they need to come up with some kind of solution, because we're talking about money here, right? We're talking about a monetary network, and the downside path of Bitcoin having a, you know, catastrophic event like this is that a lot of developers, you know, lose significant value that they've stored in the protocol. You don't really see that with almost any other open source project that's kind of non-monetary in nature, and it's relying on, you know, either a benevolent dictator who just really cares about the project, or a team of people that distributed people that just really, really care, but they don't necessarily have a direct monetary incentive, or closed source software that's, you know, behind the walls of a for-profit company. You know, maybe if you're the CTO with a large kind of equity position in the company, then a breaking change, some issue with the software would mobilize you to move really quickly and aggressively to figure it out. But there's a lot of software in the world. The point is, there's a lot of software in the world that does not kind of come equipped with this built-in incentive to get it right and to treat it well and figure these things out, you know, well ahead of time. And so I also feel comfortable that the incentives are very closely aligned between us as holders and the people who are working on the project.
Yeah. Go support your local open source dev. Our partner, Matt Odell, co-founded OpenSats. So if you're looking for a 501(c)(3) to donate to, as we head to the end of the year, you want to donate your money to save on taxes, and you want to contribute to the open source development of Bitcoin, OpenSats is a great, great use of those funds. Others like Brink exist as well. And so if you want to support individuals like Matt and open source devs working on Bitcoin, focused on these problems, that's one thing you can do to contribute. Bitcoin Mana, should we talk about it? I'll switch. I'll take off the moderator hat and throw it to you, John. You have it on the list. What do you think we should talk about as it pertains to Abu Dhabi and the week that was?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, for those that don't know, Marty was over at the Bitcoin Mana conference this week, and among various other highlights, participated in a debate on the merits of Bitcoin versus crypto broadly with Tron's Justin Sun. And we can play a clip from that or not. I'll leave it up to you and Logan. But, you know, it struck me that that this is even still, you know, a conversation that kind of needs to be had. It's something that this is on that same list of objections to, you know, why Bitcoin? Why are we interested in Bitcoin? Like, you know, won't it be outcompeted? Won't there be other chains that do XYZ thing better, faster, whatever the case may be? Over the course of the last 5 years, I feel like the chorus on that argument has gotten a lot softer, thanks partially to the blowups that we saw from broader crypto and DeFi in the last cycle. But to hear you tell it, Marty, there's still, you know, we're still very early, and there's still a lot of big pools of capital in the Middle East and elsewhere that are well-intentioned and trying to understand it, but still, you know, are just kind of coming to this conversation again. So, you know, curious to hear your takeaways on that debate, and then also, you know, what it says about the broader conversations you were having at the conference off stage.
Yeah, Logan's got up, so we'll listen to the first minute of the debate, and please excuse my aggressive hand motioning. Apparently, I don't know what to do with the mic in my hand on stage. So,
Bitcoin, and so crypto changing narratives. I mean, it went from Bitcoin's too slow, it's too dumb, it doesn't have enough transactions. We're going to create a better one. Then it evolved to ICOs. You can launch your own token. Then it went to DeFi. Now we have meme coins, and you're seeing this acceleration of these new narratives, and they're falling flat even quicker. I think the meme coin narrative, what we're seeing on platforms like Pump.Fun, is an example of this stuff just speed running as the new narrative arises over time. And I think particularly as we head into this new era of nation states adopting Bitcoin, I think the opportunity cost of playing in crypto and trying to chase new narratives is simply getting too high. I think nation states are recognizing that Bitcoin as a global reserve asset being integral is a monumental change in terms of how Bitcoin is viewed in the eyes of not only governments, but everybody around the world. And if you're in crypto trying to create a new narrative and trying to say that Bitcoin is not good enough, I think we're at the point where it's objectively false.
Yeah. So it was interesting debating Justin Sun. Very charming, which was to be expected, very nice. And he essentially agreed with all the points I was making on stage. And so I think even those in the crypto space have somewhat conceded, like, yeah, Bitcoin's winning money and crypto exists. He described it as a museum for people to go do fun things with. And when it comes to allocating capital and thinking about generational businesses and wealth that can be accrued, I think it's pretty clear to us, at least, and should be to others, that Bitcoin is where you should focus your attention and your capital. But yeah, there was, I spent a week in Abu Dhabi, first time in the Middle East. It was a really eye-opening experience, really overall great experience, just getting to meet people in the UAE and that part of the world and get their perspective on Bitcoin. So at the Bitcoin Mana conference, everybody, most people, not everybody, but most people were full bore on Bitcoin and excited about what's going on in terms of Bitcoin as and its role in this geopolitical game theory that is playing out as Trump comes into office here in the United States. It was also Abu Dhabi Finance Week. And so I stayed an extra day and went to an event, and that was completely different. The idea of DeFi and the tokenization of real world assets seems to have a lot of large swaths of capital. I would argue confused. They're certainly enamored by it. And so there's a lot of projects that are looking to tokenize real world assets, enable people that hold those tokenized real world assets to sell them on secondary markets, use them as collateral in DeFi products. And if you squint, you can see some of the epic blowups that happened in years past beginning to bubble up in a new package. But yeah, I think what I said on stage that the opportunity cost of playing in crypto markets and not focusing on Bitcoin is getting too high. If the U.S. announces a strategic reserve and others follow suit, you're taking a big risk by putting your bets outside of Bitcoin in the broader space of digital assets, in my opinion.
Yeah, I love that point that you made in that clip there, that it's all well and good 5 to 10 years ago when Bitcoin's fairly nascent and you know, sub 100 billion, sub $10 billion market cap. And there are people who certainly could kind of see the future coming and were arguing for a kind of Bitcoin maximalist strategy, if you want to call it that, from that point, but maybe more understandable to, you know, want to play around and dabble in all of the quote unquote innovation that was happening on other blockchains. But it's a great point that if, you know, we're now at a $2 trillion and looks like headed higher, and we're targeting top five, you know, assets in the world by market cap, nation states appear to be much more interested in getting involved here. It's, you know, there's a strong argument that the time has passed to kind of play around and dabble. And the time is here to really focus on where 99% of the economic value long term is going to be generated. I think it's a great point. To that point, I guess there was a meme, if you were around kind of for the last Bitcoin cycle, that the institutions are coming. You know, we heard it a ton in 2020 and 2021. Didn't really materialize until kind of last year. And then I think we can safely say with the launch of the ETFs, the institutions, you know, very much did decide to come. They just maybe waited until a more opportune moment in the price. But now the meme maybe is the nation states are coming. So Marty, curious to hear from you, having gone over to a part of the world where there may be much more kind of progressive nation states out there kind of thinking about the Bitcoin strategic reserve concept. Are the nation states coming? Are they here?
I didn't talk to anybody directly from the nation states, but I mean, that was the rumor during the whole Bitcoin Mana conference, is you should be expecting. I mean, David Bailey publicly was tweeting that there's going to be a big announcement, and behind the scenes at the conference, at the deep stage, people are saying, hey, who knows? It's hearsay. But the rumors were that these nation states have gotten in size, but they didn't want to announce publicly, because why would you? You incite an incredible run on Bitcoin when you could accumulate more cheaper. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know. Again, hearsay, rumors. I think it's pretty safe to say that there's likely at least one nation state outside of Bhutan, El Salvador, and Russia and Venezuela and the United States and China that are accumulating Bitcoin, whether that's via confiscation or overt open market purchases. I wouldn't be surprised if a large oil and gas producing nation in the part of the world I was just in is buying in size.
Bhutan was, I mean, they were exposed. What they got mixed up in BlockFi, or was it something
BlockFi
else?
BlockFi and Celsius.
So we already knew that they were mining Bitcoin, but, and maybe I missed this, but I heard in the discussion that David Bailey had with CZ during that conference that apparently they've been doing it for a long time. It wasn't like they decided to get into it a couple of years ago. Maybe that was already old news, but I'm pretty sure they had mentioned having been mining for something like 10 years. Was that already well known?
I don't know if it was 10 years. I know post. So what happened with the Kingdom of Bhutan, their sovereign wealth fund, which is a quasi private entity, Druk Holdings, it was revealed that they had assets on Celsius and BlockFi. And when the bankruptcy proceedings came out and you had public disclosures of who got caught up as a creditor in those bankruptcies, Druk Holdings was on the list. And if I remember correctly at that time, the King of Bhutan essentially had to hold its hand up and say, yes, we're in Bitcoin. We're still in it. And if I recall correctly, they said they'd been mining since early 2020. So I believe 2 years before it became public that they got caught up in these bankruptcies. And so they've definitely been in it for at least a cycle.
Yep.
And since then they've publicly leaned into it, announced partnerships with Bitdeer to expand their mining footprint. And I don't know if they wanted this to happen, but Arkham Labs has what they believe to be Druk Holdings Bitcoin wallet that you can track. And now they have over 13,000 Bitcoin, which is over 7 million sats per capita for the Kingdom of Bhutan, which is not bad.
That may be hard to top by any nation. I haven't run the numbers, but that's a pretty solid ratio to be starting out with.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good KPI for sovereigns out there to target.
Sats per capita. How high can it go? It was it was cool. It was not a fun travel experience. It was 18 hours on the way there, 26 hours on the way back. But it's the Abu Dhabi and the UAE specifically seems motivated to really lean in to Bitcoin and broader crypto. And that's what I wanted to bring up, the big meme of real world assets. And I think, John, it would be good to hear your thoughts on what we believe, like what many would label as contrarian in the space, is this idea of the Bitcoinization of finance versus the definancialization or DeFi. Decentralized financialization and sort of pulling it into the crypto world instead of Bitcoin eking into the financial world as it exists today.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree, and I think we all agree with kind of the impetus behind a lot of what led to and encouraged the growth of kind of DeFi in the prior cycle and as it exists today. And there are people today that, you know, maybe look at broader crypto and think that that's not sustainable, but they want to build other types of similar decentralized finance platforms and protocols on top of Bitcoin and with Bitcoin, and it kind of move economic activity away from the existing financial infrastructure that exists traditionally, and kind of just recreate it all on Bitcoin kind of natively without having to touch traditional financial rails. And I do think if we move over time to a hyper Bitcoinized world, if you want to call it that, that's naturally how things will develop and evolve. If Bitcoin becomes store value, medium of exchange, and unit of account broadly for essentially all economic activity, then they're going to be Bitcoin denominated capital markets too, right? That's inevitable. I think that's also probably 20 plus years away, depending on how quickly adoption moves. And in the interim, we've got anywhere from, it depends how you want to define it, but $450 to $900 trillion of assets and wealth tied up in the existing traditional finance system. Some of that can rotate relatively quickly and is rotating quickly out of stocks and bonds and real estate into and out of precious metals like gold into Bitcoin. You see everyday examples of people doing that at the institutional level and at the individual level. I think everyone on this podcast has done that with their personal balance sheets, and we know people who've done that. And so that is a driver, but there are orders of magnitude more dollars locked up in structures that can't just do that, whether it's because whether because of volatility concerns or institutional mandates or just the general what Buffett and Munger would call the institutional imperative to just to not rock the boat and not take the career risk of, you know, liquidating some fund strategy and just putting it into Bitcoin. And so that's probably good for hundreds of trillions of dollars that are not just going to flip and become Bitcoin overnight. But what they can do and what they increasingly, it seems like they want to do, is get access within their existing structure to Bitcoin price exposure in one way or another, or Bitcoin linked products, whether that's Bitcoin backed lending, Bitcoin credit. Certainly what Michael Saylor has done over the last year and change with his aggressive accumulation strategy that has tapped into the traditional convertible debt and markets and the equity market. All of those things, I think, are examples of ways to get exposure to Bitcoin and touch Bitcoin and benefit from its appreciation and its scarcity without actually flipping entirely into, you know, turning a $1 trillion strategy, taking that from, you know, private credit directly and just, you know, holding spot Bitcoin with it. I think there's going to be growing demand for that. And, you know, it's not going to be as simple as all of that just liquidating and becoming Bitcoin. It's going to kind of need to exist within, you know, existing structures. And so I think that there's a huge opportunity for creative entrepreneurs and founders and those that can kind of navigate the existing financial system well to design products that can cater to that demand. And I wouldn't be surprised if increasingly there's a lot of appetite for that from overseas sovereigns, as well as, you know, existing pools of capital in, you know, London, New York, and Tokyo, et cetera.
Yeah, the Andrew Hunt from Battery was over in Abu Dhabi, and I spent a lot of time with him while we were there. And he expressed this on, I'm trying to pull up this week's timestamp to find the name of the show. If you haven't subscribed to the 1031 timestamp, go to 1031.vc, click the timestamp and subscribe. But Andrew
It's the Less Signal, More Noise podcast.
Yes. Less Signal, More Noise with Pascal.
Or Less Noise, More Signal. Sorry, whatever it may be. But search that and you'll find it.
Yeah. With Pascal from Murky Bauman in Switzerland. And I think the way Andrew described Bitcoin as this collateral asset is it's just a tool. And you can think creatively about structuring products around this tool. And there's many different flavors and many different ways in which you can implement Bitcoin into these different strategies. We're just scratching the surface on how this is going to materialize. And to that point, I think we have it on the list as well. MicroStrategy has found a way to leverage the tool of Bitcoin to access some of this debt market capital. And they've done it so successfully that they were officially added to the NASDAQ 100 as of last Friday afternoon. So I believe they started trading in the NASDAQ 100 yesterday. Is that correct?
I think it takes effect next Monday, the 23rd.
Next Monday, okay. And one of the Bloomberg guys is estimating a 0.47% weighting in the index. How big is this for MicroStrategy as a company, Bitcoin more broadly, and those who hold the NASDAQ 100 index are passively going to get exposure to Bitcoin now?
Yeah, I mean, it makes them the 40th largest, would be the 40th largest weighting on that list, somewhere maybe 40 to 60, somewhere in that range. And yeah, I think passive is the key word, right? There's $300 billion roughly in AUM managed by QQQ. I think it's, you know, maybe second only to SPY in terms of total AUM and popularity. And so the SPY being the S&P 500 ETF and the QQQ being the ETF that tracks the NASDAQ. And people have been trained over the last 20, 30 years to kind of immediately DCA in the same way that anyone who's listening to this, you know, has been trained to kind of DCA paychecks into Bitcoin. Those who are not on the Bitcoin standard yet or have not really gone down the Bitcoin rabbit hole have, you know, been trained to do the same thing into a few kind of broad market ETFs, particularly SPY, QQQ, and maybe a few others. And so you've got now a situation where starting on December 23rd, all of those flows every 2 weeks, every, you know, a month, whatever the case may be, when paychecks hit and they immediately get turned into QQQ buys, all those people who are making those buys are going to be effectively subsidizing MicroStrategy's Bitcoin accumulation strategy. And they will, you know, indirectly on like a third or fourth order kind of exposure, have exposure to the price of Bitcoin in a very real way, in a levered way. And, you know, I think that's something that the people that have been very, very bullish on the MicroStrategy story have been calling for a long time, that MicroStrategy was going to, just based on their accumulation of Bitcoin, Bitcoin's price, they were going to hit a market cap level that would enable this to happen. And the inevitable result of that would be just yet more capital flowing into that strategy to create demand for MicroStrategy equity that then MSTR can issue into to go buy more Bitcoin. So it's, you know, tough to say what the flow impact is going to be on Bitcoin, but it's certainly a new dynamic, I think, with probably the world's most aggressive buyer of Bitcoin that we're aware of now having passive flows kind of coming into the stock indirectly that they can issue into to just pour more gasoline on the Bitcoin purchase fire. So, you know, at the very least, I don't think it's bearish for the price of Bitcoin. I'll say that.
Grant, anything to add?
Not really. I mean, I think that among the crowd that of these, let's call them institutional investors that I've been talking to, there is a pretty wide viewpoint, or pretty common viewpoint, that this trade is going to blow up for MicroStrategy. Like, a lot of people, there are lots of people who think what they've done is genius. And I certainly think there's a lot. I mean, there's lots of capital that, for whatever reason, is not comfortable or not allowed to invest in Bitcoin directly. And what MicroStrategy has done to sort of slice up different ways to get exposure to it has clearly struck a nerve, and there's tons of demand for it. But there is a common viewpoint that, like, this is going to blow up for them somehow, which I think is just interesting, because they don't really know how. They're just sort of saying that. So it's interesting to imagine, are there scenarios like that, that they really could come to bite them? But not obvious to me that that's a significant risk. So yeah, I don't have anything else to add on that.
I get the instincts from, you know, pattern matching to last cycle or to prior cycles, where when you combine anything that looks like leverage and Bitcoin, like, eventually that blows up. We've just, like, seen it time and time again. And there are, you know, good reasons for that. Bitcoin's, you know, incredibly volatile, and it can have 200% pumps within a couple of months, and it can also have 50%+ drawdowns within, you know, a couple of weeks. And, you know, traditional leverage generally just doesn't mix well with something like that as the collateral. If it's, you know, not managed well, if the LTVs aren't appropriate, and if there's, you know, constant marking to market, there are other ways where Bitcoin is fantastic collateral, but the structure has to make sense. And I would actually posit, I think MicroStrategy is one of those structures where, you know, it does make a lot of sense. It makes much more sense than the you know, casinos and degen kind of bucket shops that we saw over the last couple of cycles that were much more vulnerable to, you know, a liquidation overnight, you know, a sudden wipeout. And I think the key is that the, you know, none of the debt is secured. There's no mark to market concept. It's all convertible. And I think they're in just a much different position than most of the traditional, like, levered Bitcoin plays, where I think in a lot of cases, if you run the math over a multi-year period, the stock can go down a lot in bearish Bitcoin scenarios and scenarios where the NAV multiple collapses. But I think there are a lot of cases where stock goes down a lot, but Saylor never becomes a forced seller. And so he can just survive till the next cycle, assuming another cycle exists, and, you know, ride that wave. And so I think you have to believe the way that it would blow up, in my view, is we have an 80% plus drawdown, and we stay there for, like, multiple years to the point that the converts are no longer in the money, and you have an event where they have to be paid back. back at par, and Saylor either has to issue a massive amount of equity that, you know, further causes a death spiral, or he has to sell a bunch of Bitcoin or something like that. But I don't think it's a traditional levered Bitcoin play like we've seen before. What I'd worry about more is the miners trying to do the same strategy. You know, I won't name names, but there are large publicly traded miners that are doing something similar. And I think they're trying to start doing something similar at scale. And I would worry that they are potentially in more of a position to become forced sellers much more quickly at the next Bitcoin bear market, which I think, you know, I know Marty believes it's a super cycle and we're never going, you know, never going down again. But if it did happen, that's where, because of the razor thin economics of that kind of business and the capital intensity and the existing, you know, debt burdens that are on some of those companies, it seems like you could see a much higher likelihood of that strategy eventually blowing up and leading to, you know, forced selling of Bitcoin that then ushers in, you know, the next kind of liquidation cascade for people.
Yeah.
That's probably what I'd worry about.
Yeah. Their cash flows or their sats flows are directly correlated to the price of Bitcoin. So they could get sort of the double whammy. And even though it might seem at the outset, launching all these 0% interest convertible notes, well, that seems pretty cost effective and very manageable on the P&L, just from a cash cost perspective. That doesn't mean that there's not refinancing risk. And the refinancing risk is sort of like one of the major risk for those groups.
Yeah, I guess add my thoughts as it pertains to MicroStrategy specifically. The only question I have is, like, does the strategy hit like a scaling limit, particularly taking their cash flows into consideration? Like, do they reach a point where their cash flows aren't sufficient enough to scale the convertible debt strategy as high as they would like to? Which begs the question, I mean, Saylor's talked about this publicly, like, eventually they want to turn MicroStrategy into a Bitcoin bank that does introduce new revenue streams by doing things with their Bitcoin. And John and I were actually talking about one of the ways in which that may manifest in the future, and it's a topic that is frowned upon due to the blow-ups that have happened, particularly with Celsius, BlockFi, Genesis, which got Gemini Earn customers caught up, which is like Bitcoin yield. And it's hard. It's a subject that behind the scenes we've been talking about how to approach tactfully, because people hear yield on Bitcoin and have a visceral reaction, and that visceral reaction is warranted based on everything that's happened historically in markets, particularly participants who went to get yield on your Bitcoin. But the maturation of Bitcoin insurance products and the ability for people to put Bitcoin up as pools of capital in insurance products and reap the benefits of a split of the premium paid for those insurance policies is one of the risk-adjusted ways to get yield on your Bitcoin that makes somewhat sense to me and could be something that MicroStrategy may want to think about getting into if they need to produce more cash flows to continue the strategy.
I feel like the yield being a dirty word, again, like, the pattern matching makes sense. I think the underlying issue with the last cycle's yield is that it was based on unsustainable phantom economic activity, right? Like, it's not so much that there was an attempt to get yield, it's that the underlying producer of that yield, it was like a recursive perpetual motion machine that, you know, made no sense. And there are definitely going to be more of those in the future. But if you imagine a world like a fully hyper Bitcoinized world, or a world where there's a ton of capital already in Bitcoin, there will still be economic activities taking place where it makes sense for me to, you know, invest in your project, you know, at some sort of, you know, fixed income type structure and, you know, receive a yield on it. And I'm putting capital at risk to do that. In that case, you know, there will be default risks. Some of those will blow up. Some of those won't work out. In some cases, I won't get paid back at par. But I think there will be a lot of scenarios where in a lot of businesses that do generate, you know, Bitcoin yield, it'll be a higher hurdle than fiat yield for sure. And Grant's talked about that a lot with his writing and talks on Sats flows, which I recommend everyone should go check out. But I don't necessarily think that yield as such is the problem. It's that the yield that we've been able to generate in broader crypto over the last 15 years has been based on, you know, fairy dust and you know, smoke and unsustainable perpetual motion machines that we're always going to blow up.
Yeah. I spent a Matt Dines from Build Asset Management was over in Abu Dhabi as well. And I spent a lot of time with him and he brought up a good point. We should actually have him on to walk through this. He's the credit guru within Bitcoin. And he was making some good points about the literal capital limitations that exist within the convertible bond market specifically. Like there's, I believe, only $80 billion worth of corporate convertible bonds. I think that's how large the market is now. So you have scaling limitations there unless that market expands because the strategy proves to be worthwhile. But you'd have to imagine with sort of risk mandates and allocation mandates from these credit funds, they may just be limited to what they can actually allocate to the convertible bond market specifically. And we had some really good conversations about the evolution of Bitcoin being incorporated with different types of corporate debt markets. And I think he has some really, really good ideas. And I think the gist of what he was getting at is that we're going to evolve from this ability to speculative attack these convertible bond markets to a more mature state where a business producing healthy cash flows and cash flows that are increasing is going to be an imperative to tap into these, the other corporate bond markets that exist.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being the case. We'll have to get Matt on to talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a long week. I mean, it's been a couple of weeks since we've done this. I'm just thinking back the night before I left for Abu Dhabi, or the night I left for Abu Dhabi, I was in New York doing the Unchained signature client event at PubKey with Andrew Hones. And that was another thing on the subject of Bitcoin and corporate debt. I think that's one thing that's beginning to materialize now is this duration curve. You have something like Unchained's lending desk, which is short duration, high interest rates. And that's one thing we've been talking about internally at 1031 and publicly. And all the shows is that it seems like a mispriced credit product, considering the way in which the Bitcoin secured and the track record of Unchained's desk and other products like it specifically. And what Andrew is really getting at, and I think what Battery's trying to attack and Matt Dines and the Build Asset Management team is trying to facilitate as well, as this materialization of a duration curve where you have different types of credit products that offer lending over different durations that lock up Bitcoin across those durations. And you begin to see a yield curve formed, which makes it easier for capital allocators to make informed decisions when they're interacting with these types of products too. So that's another thing to look out for as we head into this next cycle and the Bitcoinization of credit markets continues in earnest.
I will say last comment from me. We should note we were not over 100K last episode that we did. So we promised a new episode with every major new all-time high, and I think we fell down on the job a little bit, but we can maybe have an excuse since we had a lot of travel over the last couple of weeks. But to officially document it, we are now well over 100K, and I'm not going to make a call on whether we go below again, but I think the stars are aligning to feel very bullish about, you know, the next year.
If we're wrapping up and providing last comments, the last thing I would say is a lot of people are getting really excited about the price, and rightfully so. But I find it really interesting that I don't see many people making the connection between, all right, well, if the price is going up, like, what does that necessarily imply for adoption in the space? And what does that imply for the companies building the products and services to serve, you know, people who are holding Bitcoin, that make it easier to access it and use it and hold it and do interesting things with it and borrow from it? And we're seeing very positive momentum within our portfolio. We've been working on some really exciting things, and that's what I'm really bullish about. You know, there's the saying like lightning in a bottle. Like, I feel like we have multiple lightning bolts bottled up, and what we're seeing in the price is certainly interesting, but I think more people will start gravitating towards what's happening in the ecosystem from a technology infrastructure perspective. And I think there's going to be, going into next year, there's going to be a lot of strategic interest, not just in Bitcoin as a strategic reserve asset, but the companies that are building on top of it. So I'm very excited about that.
What do you guys think? Are we going to get another one of these in before the new year? Should we say Happy New Year to everybody, or we got one more in us?
I think we can pull it off.
Okay. All right, good.
Let's do it.
You know, I got it. I mean, I was just wondering. Nobody's going on vacation here, are we? No.
No.
Another heartfelt thank you to Matt Carallo for joining us. Very busy man. Hit him up this morning. He was gracious enough to join us for what was supposed to be 10 to 15 minutes, turned into 40 minutes. I hope his explanation of quantum computing and whether or not it is a threat to Bitcoin help quell any fears you may have had after watching the All In podcast last week. If you want to get the Bitcoin Alpha, you come to this podcast. You don't go to All In. Okay. It's in the name after all. The Bitcoin Alpha is here. It's not on All In. All In's this nice shiny object. They like to talk a big game, but the Alpha's here. We'll see you guys before the end of the year.